This is Functional Medicine Update for April 2006, Volume 26, Number 4. This month's issue is devoted to the topic of estrogen and autoimmune disease. We will begin by reviewing the Women's Initiative Health Study on Obesity and Diet, and then feature the Journal of American Medical Association's paper on the risks to vascular function related to arginine. We will then review the commentary of Dr. Louis J. Agnero, pointing out the flaws in this paper. This will be followed by the NIH report on progress toward handling autoimmune disease. Our interview this month is with Dr. Eleanor Rogan, discussing her research on estrogen metabolism. We'll complete the issue with the methylation of estrogens by nutrient management and postpartum seizures. Now here's Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for April 2006, the month of our annual symposium, and hopefully you were there to enjoy what will be, I think, considered a landmark as we look back at our 13th symposium. The focus of this month's Functional Medicine Update is on estrogen. Estrogen-related dysfunctions, estrogen-related functional capabilities in physiology. And I think that we'll be very excited to listen to our researcher of the month this month, who is actually coming back for a second time after a 2.5-year absence, Dr. Eleanor Rogan from the Epley Institute at the University of Nebraska School of Medicine, to talk about her extraordinary pioneering work in estrogen metabolism. But before I get to that, let me speak a little bit briefly about the Women's Health Initiative. As you probably recall, the Women's Health Initiative was this extraordinary study of 161,808 women aged 50 through 79 years. This multimillion dollar 15-year project was really focused on trying to understand the relative impact that diet and lifestyle and other factors have on women's health postmenopausally. So in this particular study, we've seen hormone therapy, calcium and vitamin D supplements, dietary patterns, and lifestyle patterns all being looked at as it relates to the prevention of heart disease, cancer, and osteoporosis, respectively. And we certainly owe Dr. Bernadette Healy, the previous director of the National Institutes of Health, for this advocacy to do this extraordinary bit of work to try to understand more the gender-specific relationship between risk factor and age-related disease in women, and particularly focus on the peri- and postmenopausal period in women's lives, a period that is obviously associated with increasing incidence of breast cancer, of heart disease, and of bone loss, bone fracture, and osteoporosis. So through this extraordinary bit of work, which is now starting to be analyzed, and the data, which is massive, starting to be looked at from multiple different perspectives, we've seen things like the relationship between low-fat diets and weight change, which is one of the more recently published parts of the Women's Health Initiative. And the outcome of that particular study, I think, is quite fascinating because, as you recall, there has been this trend over the last several years that carbohydrates somehow increases weight gain and is the scourge of our population. And as a consequence of carbohydrate intake, we're seeing insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and rampant obesity. And this speaks in opposition to what was the previous concept, that a high complex carbohydrate, high fiber, lower fat type diet actually achieved weight loss and lowered insulin and better glycemic control and better lipid patterns. So it seems paradoxical that we swung from the high carbohydrate to the low carbohydrate regime as being a favorable diet. The low-fat diet connection to heart disease in postmenopausal women, therefore, is part of trying to understand this dietary connection to disease risk. And of course, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 295, page 39 in 2006, the title of the paper was Low-Fat Dietary Pattern and Weight Change Over 7 Years. Initially, the investigators had targeted trying to get the fat calorie percent in the intervention group down to 25 or lower calorie percent. In actual fact, this was not achieved. The women didn't comply with a diet that was that low in fat. It was able to lower the average fat intake by about 9 calorie percent over the standard American diet group or the control group. So it was a modestly fat-restricted carbohydrate-increased diet, and therefore the results of the study would probably be considered intermediary or somewhat compromised because the fat restriction was not achieved at the level that was proposed. However, as you probably know, the outcome of the trial, even with that limitation, did indicate that there was a weight loss, marginal and small in amount, but it was a weight loss, not a weight gain, in the individual on the lower-fat, higher-carbohydrate diet. And therefore, the concept that a carbohydrate-rich diet increases body fat didn't seem to be true based upon this study. Now, there are a number of variables that probably you have to take into account when you're looking at this, and I think one of the most important that we often forget is what type of fat, what type of carbohydrate, and what type of protein. And it's becoming more and more apparent to me that although we've spent so much of our time focusing on calorie percent of each of these macronutrients, that really the actual composition of those families, those compartments, is as or more important than the number of calorie percent that they represent. So if we talk about carbohydrate as refined carbohydrate, sugars and starches, highly white type of diet, that will have a different physiological effect from that of a diet with the same number of calorie percent carbohydrates that come as minimally processed grains that are rich in fiber and are not rich in bleached starch. And as a consequence, you get a whole not only different in the digestibility and absorption of the glucose molecules that come from carbohydrate, but you also get the association in the minimally processed diet with literally hundreds, probably thousands of different phytochemicals which influence physiology through their individual signaling properties to gene expression patterns. And so when one really looks at carbohydrate in the straight Pritikin or Ornish approach, we're really talking about a different kind of carbohydrate than we're talking about, which is just increased white carbohydrate, starch, flour products in the refined state. So I think we often get caught up in this carbohydrate fat protein argument when we're really missing the focus, which should be on the composition of the diet in its total nature, of which the carbohydrate can bring then forth in a minimally processed plant food rich diet many different other nutrients, soluble fibers, insoluble fibers, lignans, isoflavones, polyphenols, carotenoids, xanthophylls, all these other bioactive molecules that come in the minimally processed diet that influence function. But notwithstanding that was not controlled for in the Women's Health Initiative dietary intervention trial, we still saw by decreasing fat by about 9 calorie percent, and that means increasing percent carbohydrate calories, there was no increase in body weight. Actually, there was a statistically significant, marginally significant lowering of body weight. So I think that the question really comes to how do we get this epidemic of obesity to be arrested? And the individuals who wrote the editorial to the JAMA article on the Women's Health Initiative low-fat diet study, I think hit upon some very important information. This is Michael Danziger and Ernst Schaefer, who you know were the co-authors of a previous study that was published in JAMA about a year ago that we reviewed in Functional Medicine Update, that compared the Atkins, Ornish, Weight Watchers, and Zone diets for weight loss and heart disease risk reduction. This was published in JAMA in 2005, volume 293, page 45. And these authors, who then went on to write the editorial to the 2006 paper, went on to say, quote, "Is it time to admit defeat? Is U.S. society doomed to be one of those few individuals who maintain body weight and one-third of the adults are obese?" We see that this recent low-fat diet Women's Health Initiative does little to reassure skeptics, and some see no hope on the horizon. Many believe humankind does not have the self-control to counterbalance the forces that create a predictable wave of obesity in technologically advancing societies. Some believe national governments will never enact the bold policy changes that could make a dent in the obesity rates, such as substantially altering food advertising practices and creating economic incentives for vigorous adherence to lifestyle recommendations. Even modest steps, such as limiting advertising of unhealthy food during child's television programming or placing small taxes on unhealthy foods, are met with seemingly insurmountable resistance from the food industry and others. With a government and society that seemingly reject the pursuit of economic and other reforms that could make a real difference, the burden of obesity treatment and prevention continues to rest on the shoulders of, quote, individual responsibility, end quote, period. Well, I think that's a very interesting perspective, and one certainly that is worthy of our attention. If we are constantly feeding our children and adults molecules that create a different message that translates into storage rather than metabolic utilization, then we are going to see a continued increase in this obesity epidemic with what might be considered very severe consequences of the youth as they grow into adulthood with regard to coronary artery disease, stroke, and maybe certain cancers that are associated with hyperinsulinemia. So I think we have to start asking questions that are different than the questions that have been asked in the past about just calorie restriction and changing the protein, carbohydrate, fat ratios of diets. We need to look at the complex nature of the diet that creates then the signaling in cells that regulate appetite and regulate physiology and metabolism so that usable energy is available for physiology and that storage is less likely to occur. Storage for this rainy day that never comes called adipocyte hypertrophy, where we start storing lipids in our fat cells, producing central adiposity, insulin resistance, and adipocytokines that induce inflammation. So I think that we are looking for a different model. We need to lock people away in a room and say, come up with a better model, because this concept of restricting calories and being on weight loss diets and eating less of the same foods that we have available in commerce, which send the wrong messages to our genes and produce an outcome called dysfunction and inflammation, is just not a model that's working. We need to find a different thing than the first law of thermodynamics to try to address this obesity problem. And I think that, to me, is the takeaway that I derive out of this article from the Women's Health Initiative. Yes, there was a minor weight loss that was seen in these individuals by restricting some degree of fat in their diet, but it was not of significance enough to really deal with the major nature of this sea change that's occurring in obesity. And we need to find a different model. And I think this model relates to finding how to signal to the cells through proper nutrigenomic signaling, outcome that is related to proper physiology and appetite regulation through the gut, the liver, the pancreas, the muscles, the adipocyte cells, and the brain all working cooperatively to regulate what has evolutionarily been built into our genes, but we've just overcome it. We've overridden it. We know how to eat. Our genes know how to control these aspects of physiology. We've just been sending toxic molecular signals through a toxomolecular diet that creates these outcomes called ponderousness and gluttony and lack of self-control. People don't elect to eat gluttonously. It's the number of things that we're signaling to this regulatory system that creates the outcome. And it's not just so simple as, say, cut calories, because if we cut calories and we're still delivering to that person these false messages, these toxic messages, it's likely we're going to have the same outcome. So that, I think, is my takeaway from the Women's Health Initiative Weight Management, a Lower Fat Diet Study. As it relates to a companion issue that appeared in the same issue of the Journal of American Medical Association that I was just describing, this was the 2006 issue, volume 295, but in this case, the article appeared on page 58 of that same issue of the journal. This is another interesting example of how a nutrient component can have effect upon cellular signaling and physiology. And now I'm talking about an amino acid that is found within protein, arginine, L-arginine. Now, L-arginine has been in the news considerably over the last, now nearly 15 years. You recall that in the middle 1990s, nitric oxide was the molecule of the year, and we recognize that nitric oxide was formed in cellular physiology by way of the conversion of arginine into citrulline and the formation of a nitric oxide molecule. This won three individuals the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1998. One of those was Dr. Luis Ignaro, distinguished professor of pharmacology at the University of California at Los Angeles. And it was suggested that L-arginine could be useful for improving vascular compliance, improving endothelial nitric oxide, and lowering blood pressure, and helping improve vascular endothelial outcome and function in individuals with damaged endothelium. This is work that we actually were very fortunate to have surveyed and interviewed Dr. John Cook, cardiology researcher from Stanford University some years ago on Functional Medicine Update, in which he talked about his clinical intervention trials using oral arginine supplements in individuals, first in primates and then later in humans, with individuals with hypercholesterolemia and individuals who had vascular defects and vascular endothelial injury, and finding that, in fact, supplemental L-arginine seemed to improve their vascular function and improved endothelial function. Well, that then takes us forward to the more recent paper that I was describing in the Journal of American Medical Association entitled L-arginine Therapy in Acute Myocardial Infarction. This was a description of the vascular interaction with age and myocardial infarction randomized clinical trial, the so-called VINTAGE, V-I-N-T-A-G-E, MI trial. And you might recall that this was a study where the amino acid L-arginine was utilized as a supplement in a single-centered, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. This was an intervention trial from February 2002 to June 2004. And this was done at Johns Hopkins University. The principal investigator was Stephen Schulman and his colleagues. There was a total of 153 patients following a first ST segment elevation myocardial infarction. So these were post-infarct patients that were all quite sick. And basically, in this particular trial, patients were randomized to receive either L-arginine. The goal was to get them to take 3 grams of L-arginine 3 times a day, or 9 grams total, or a matching placebo for 6 months. And then they looked at change in gated blood pool-derived ejection fraction over 6 months in patients 60 years or older were randomized to receive L-arginine compared with those who received a placebo. The results, baseline characteristics, vascular stiffness measurements, and left ventricular function were similar among participants randomized. And then at the end of the intervention trial, it was found that there was no significant change from baseline to 6 months in the vascular stiffness measurements or left ventricular ejection fraction, either of the two groups, including those 60 years or older. The one thing, however, that pointed out was that the L-arginine group, 6 participants or 8.6, died during the first 6 months of the study versus none in the placebo group. So they go on to suggest that this is a significant potential risk factor. This raises questions, doesn't it, about what happens if you put a person on a high vegetable-based diet, which is rich in L-arginine, and they have vascular defects. Might you induce, then, some injury? So it's not just L-arginine given as a supplement, but you recall arginine is found in high quantities in proteins, particularly in vegetable-based proteins, where the arginine to lysine ratio is increased in vegetable-based proteins. So it might, you know, imply that dietary proteins that are high in L-arginine given to people with post-infarct injury would be at risk to a more serious outcome. That doesn't seem to really play with the data that has been previously published, in which it's said that vegetable-based diets actually decrease the relative risk to secondary heart attacks, and that one would want to recommend diets whose proteins were probably by nature richer in arginine. So some of these things just don't seem to line up. Or is there a difference between L-arginine given as a supplement to post-MI patients versus arginine in the diet? Again, many, many different questions, because we would assume that L-arginine from dietary protein would be delivered into the blood once the protein had been digested. It would be absorbed into the blood and produce a postprandial elevation of L-arginine, similar to that one we'd get with supplementing with equivalent amounts of purified or isolated L-arginine. So with all of this as kind of a swirling debate, I asked Dr. Louis Giagnaro, the distinguished professor of molecular and medical pharmacology at UCLA, if he might give his opinion about this particular trial. We know that in pharmacology, Tolman's law tells us that all substances are toxic at some level, even air and water. So the question is really, what is the level of potential toxicity and relative risk of L-arginine, if at all, in individuals with specific types of cardiovascular defects? So with this in mind, Dr. Ignaro pointed out the following concerns he has about the JAMA published study. First of all, patient selection. He said this clinical study was performed with obviously very sick patients suffering from advanced cardiovascular disease. They were receiving several different types of potent drugs to treat their condition. We know that these individuals have very brittle physiological function that is very sensitive to interaction with any additional bioactive agent. Although L-arginine is not a drug, we certainly know as an amino acid that it has bioactivity. So in order to test the potential therapeutic benefit of L-arginine or a functional food, it seems prudent to design the clinical study carefully and to use a measurable endpoint as to how that substance might influence function, rather than a gross parameter, which is either ejection fraction or, in this case, the endpoint of death, which is a very crude indicator, obviously, of modifying function. So he went on to talk about study design and endpoints. He said the Vintage MI clinical trial was designed to test whether the addition of L-arginine to standard post-infarct patients following the first STEMI over 6 months would decrease vascular stiffness. He goes on to point out that there is a serious flaw in this design and the expected therapeutic response to L-arginine because nitric oxide generated from L-arginine is a vascular smooth muscle relaxant and inhibitor of platelet function. It has effect on small vessel compliance, and there is no evidence to suggest it would influence vascular stiffness of the large arteries. Increasing the production of nitric oxide would not be expected to alter vascular stiffness, he points out. Therefore, the design and rationale for the study was ill-conceived. As it relates to sample size and outcome, he points out that the patient sample size was small and the statistical evaluation was marginally significant. It is clear that the control patient group itself not receiving L-arginine experienced a mortality of greater than 10%, as would be expected in a group of patients this ill. The percentage of patients taking L-arginine who died during the study was well less than 10%. This means that the deaths of the patients taking L-arginine were likely attributed to chance. Indeed, he points out, the authors themselves indicate this is a likely possibility in their write-up. Therefore, a second and larger clinical study might reveal no significant response to L-arginine in a similar subset of patients. Accordingly, it's premature, unscientific, and unethical to conclude that the patient deaths in the study were attributable to the ingestion of L-arginine. Now, he goes on to talk about lack of proof of a cause and effect relationship. He says a small clinical trial does not provide any evidence for a cause and effect relationship between L-arginine and death in these sick patients. There is no evidence arginine was responsible for the patient deaths. Moreover, there is no scientific or statistical evidence for any association between L-arginine administration and death. And then five, he talks about a flaw with proposed mechanism of action. When a beneficial or detrimental response to a substance ingested by the human is reported in the literature, the authors are obligated to provide a clear rationale for the study and a viable hypothesis to explain the response. Neither was done in the study. The hypothesis afforded to explain the potentially harmful action of L-arginine in this patient population is flawed and scientifically unsound. The authors concluded that tetrahydrobiopterin levels were deficient in these sick patients and that this condition resulted in more superoxyanion production than normal at the expense of nitric oxide. That is, L-arginine is normally converted by nitric oxide synthase to nitric oxide plus L-citrulline in the presence of adequate amounts of tetrahydrobiopterin. But when the tetrahydrobiopterin is deficient, more superoxyanion than nitric oxide is formed. Since superoxide anion is an oxygen radical, the thinking is that this excessive production of superoxide could cause local tissue injury. There are many flaws in the application of this hypothesis to the current findings. First, no measurement of tissue levels of tetrahydrobiopterin were made. Second, the quantity of nitric oxide synthase in the affected tissues in these patients was not determined, and there would have to be a very high level of nitric oxide synthase to make enough superoxide anion to be of any concern. Third, it seems that the authors were not familiar with the biochemistry of nitric oxide. It is well known that when nitric oxide synthase is saturated with L-arginine, the enzyme produces exclusively nitric oxide and no superoxide anion. This can be demonstrated clearly in vitro. As L-arginine concentration increases, no superoxide anion production occurs. The cell would have to be deficient in L-arginine for the production of any appreciable quantities of superoxide anion to occur. As these patients were given relatively large doses of oral L-arginine, it is highly likely from past studies that their cells were not deficient in L-arginine. Indeed, the likely presence of saturating concentrations of L-arginine around nitric oxide synthase would assure only little or no production of superoxide. Therefore, the authors incorrectly conclude that tissue tetrahydrobiopterin deficiency might have caused increased production of superoxide. Next, he talks about the inappropriate mechanistic connection of L-arginine to atherosclerosis. He says the authors claim that an increase in inducible nitric oxide synthase can increase in patients with atherosclerosis. There is a well-recognized relationship between inflammatory markers and atherosclerosis. However, immune-inducible nitric oxide synthase is a marker of inflammation rather than a cause of it. Indeed, iNOS goes up in order to produce more nitric oxide to act as an anti-atherogenic agent in the body. The authors claim that the increased nitric oxide can react with superoxide that might then be formed to produce peroxynitrite, a potentially dangerous substance that can cause tissue injury. This is theoretically possible, but there has been no evidence for this in vivo. The current belief is that insufficient peroxynitrite would likely be produced to elicit any deleterious effect in tissues. Moreover, the nitric oxide and superoxide anion would have to be generated very rapidly in precisely the same spot in order to allow the two to react chemically to form peroxynitrite. As discussed above, the presence of such a large concentration of L-arginine in these patients who ingested L-arginine would make it highly unlikely that any superoxide anion was generated. And then lastly, he talks about the inappropriate connection of arginine to homocysteine, saying the authors make a statement that L-arginine administration causes an increase in plasma homocysteine levels, and this could increase the risk of heart failure. Again, the statement is incorrect. It is well known that one of the most important physiological roles for nitric oxide in the body is to function as an antioxidant to lower the levels of homocysteine and therefore protect against atherosclerosis and atherogenesis. And there's a lack of balance in describing the influence of L-arginine on vascular function. The authors have chosen to ignore the extensive literature documenting that L-arginine administration in animals and humans with atherosclerosis causes a provocative reversal of inflammation and tissue disease state. L-arginine administration in animals also increases the expression of endothelial nitric oxide synthase, which serves to allow the production of more nitric oxide in the blood vessels, thereby slowing the progression of atherosclerosis. So with regard to Dr. Ignaro's comments on this JAMA paper, one might ask, how did this ever enter into being published in JAMA when there are so many papers that vie for publication in this primary peer-reviewed journal? Why did it rise up in the editor's mind to receive this distinguished place for publication and not end up in a secondary or tertiary journal where it could be seen as an N-of-1 type study that would require more full evaluation to demonstrate proof of the model? I think those are interesting questions that we still have that come up in this field as to why there seems to be a very interesting frequency of published studies related to nutrient impact on physiology that have a negative spin that end up in primary journals whose methodologies are often flawed or limited in size and fall prey of the same criticism that often is levied against nutrition studies that show a positive effect, and that is they're not done with a large enough study group, they don't have a high enough statistical significance, they don't have the mechanism completely understood. When that criticism is levied against something that comes out positive, it doesn't appear in the journal. It's rejected. When that is levied against something that shows a negative outcome, it seems to somehow rise up and end up being published. So it raises some very interesting questions about editorial philosophy and editorial bias that I think we need to take into account as we evaluate the published literature. That leads us obviously into a discussion of the estrogen connection to things like autoimmune disease. As you probably recognize, autoimmune disease is seen almost 90%, the most common forms of rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus, are very female-centered disorders. Recently, there was a very remarkable report that had been published by our U.S. Department of Health and Human Services through the NIH entitled the Autoimmune Diseases Coordinating Committee Report, Progress in Autoimmune Disease Research. This can be found on the web, published March 2005, it's actually the summary of a report to Congress on the progress in autoimmune disease. And this particular report contains some very remarkable statistics that I think get our attention. It turns out that autoimmune disease is much more prevalent than was previously recognized. And the reason for that is that it's been broken up historically into 8 or more different clinical conditions and never kind of put together as an aggregate of conditions to look at the total number of people affected. And when you do that, you find that collectively somewhere around 23.5 million people in this country have, for reasons that we're still trying to understand, autoimmune disease, and the prevalence is rising on a percentage of the population. In fact, the number of people affected rivals that of the other major disease indicators, including that of things like dyslipidemia, insulin resistance, and hypertension. So this autoimmune family of disorders, which is on the rise, is certainly a very significant problem. The other thing that this report points out, which I think is very interesting, is that the conditions, although they had been segmented as independent disease conditions and siloed under the diagnostic terms, are now being found to be correlated through various immunological mechanisms. And so our distinction of disease one being different than the other, as if we could completely segregate myasthenia gravis from systemic lupus erythematosus, from multiple sclerosis, from ulcerative colitis, is now starting to lose some of that degree of differentiation. And we're starting to look at very similar mechanisms of immunological imbalance and dysregulation of the thymus-dependent 1 and thymus-dependent 2 lymphocyte system that better helps us to understand the etiology of the diseases and their potential origin. So that actually leads to what I would call a functional medicine approach, more focused on mechanism and less focused on medical taxonomy and disease diagnosis as the sine qua non for understanding these diseases. We now recognize that as we start to examine mechanisms that connect these diseases one to the other, that estrogen and estrogen metabolism seems to be one of the variables, metabolic variables, that is associated with these conditions that may help us to better understand why they're more common in women than men. And in fact, in this particular report, this very nicely written and lengthy report, they go through a discussion of the metabolic and environmental factors that are associated, as well as the genetic factors, with autoimmune diseases. The first thing they pointed out is that there is no single allele genes that connect to these individual autoimmune diseases. So you don't have a gene for thyroiditis and a gene for rheumatoid arthritis and a gene for multiple sclerosis, but rather there are families of genes that interrelate then immunological susceptibility or sensitivity to environmental triggers that then can weave together to give rise to the outcome that we call autoimmunity or immunological imbalance. About a third of these disorders has now been said to have a genetic relationship, which then implies two-thirds of these disorders are related to environmental factors, both internal and external environmental factors, that then weave together to give rise to the expression in the phenotype of the disease. Now, when we talk about something that's two-thirds related to the environment, or 67% environmentally related, it then addresses very strongly the hypothesis that we should be spending more time trying to understand environmental relationships rather than just trying to focus on genetic propensity, that certainly part of prognostic screening would be an understanding of genes of risk. But then beyond that, we would want to look at the environmental modifiers that give rise then to the potential outcome of expression of the immune system that we then diagnose as immune disease or as autoimmunity. So this is, I think, a very, very interesting part of the emerging story, is to start looking at things that are related to key factors that can modulate the expression of autoimmune susceptibility. Of course, these are reducible or modifiable factors. Once you understand, they potentially can be altered by modifying the environment. So we talk about what are environmental factors. And in this report, they say that although approximately one-third of the risk of developing an autoimmune disease can be attributed to heritable factors, the remainder, as I said, is thought to be associated with non-inherited events. And these include things like mercury in the environment and other toxic heavy metals that are now being seen as potential immune activating substances in sensitive individuals. They include also things like chemicals and xenobiotic exposures. In this particular paper, they talk about halogenated hydrocarbons and polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons and polychlorinated biphenyls as all having potential xenobiotic risk to the immunological system. We know about such things as drug-induced systemic lupus erythematosus. This is a variant form associated with increased levels of single-stranded DNA autoantibodies. And as a consequence, these individuals have a unique reaction to exposure to a chemical, a new-to-nature molecule that comes in certain drugs, that then induces an autoantibody against their tissues. So now we start to piece together that this is possibly a total load effect. You start adding one layer onto another on your immunological system until in that individual's uniqueness, they start expressing what appears to be autoantibodies, the immune system reacting with itself. But maybe it's reacting with things that have come as a consequence of injury to self. We know that infectious agents are the most often cited environmental factors implicated as triggers of autoimmune disease. You know about the classic example of the group A beta hemolytic streptococcus in the development of rheumatic heart disease. Also, acute Guillain-Barré syndrome has been associated with a number of bacterial and viral infections. And even reactive arthritis has been linked to a variety of intestinal infections. So we start seeing focal infection. These could be things like a root canal or a dysbiosis of the gut or a sinusitis that may then be a site where you have continued leakage of bacterial or viral products that initiate immune imbalance. And of course, lifestyle and dietary factors are now starting to be seen as much more important. Diets that are very high in total calories and fat calories induce then increasing injury to DNA and produce funny DNA for which the immune system may recognize these as foreigners and start to form antibodies against DNA that we call anti-DNA autoantibodies. It's actually against a foreign DNA that's come as a consequence of oxidative injury to native DNA. So diet's starting to see as a potential additional modifying factor for the expression of autoimmune disease. We, of course, know about food allergy, food sensitivity being immunologically able to modify function, gluten being the one that stands out with conditions like thyroiditis and ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. We're starting to witness much more understanding of how the food of one may be the poison of another as it relates to the immune system. So I think as I read through this document published by the National Institutes of Health, I recognize that we are in a very dramatic period of change related to how we view the origin of autoimmune disease. The other feature, obviously, is that of estrogen. And it used to be thought that 17-beta estradiol was correlated very strongly with that of autoimmune disease. But now there's more and more evidence indicating that estrogen metabolites, possibly the 16-hydroxylated estrogens, and maybe the 4-hydroxylated estrogens may be precipitating metabolites for immunological imbalance, inducing immunological activation of inflammation. And we'll talk more about estrogen metabolites with our researcher of the month in a moment, Dr. Eleanor Rogan. But I want to bring into this discussion the female-centeredness of autoimmune disease and how that may relate to androgen-estrogen balance and estrogen metabolism. Recall, if you would, that we know that some of the therapies for arthritis have to do with increasing androgens, like administering DHEA at high levels with systemic lupus erythematosus patients, or giving Aromadex or some of these aromatase inhibitors, which has shown some benefit, taking women off birth control pills to lower estrogen exposure. Giving tamoxifen has even been found by blocking estrogen signaling to decrease some of the effects that are seen in autoimmune disease, some of the signs and symptoms. So clearly there's an estrogen metabolism component. What is interesting is the exacerbation and signs and symptoms of autoimmunity doesn't appear to be directly correlated with the plasma levels of 17-beta estradiol, but rather seems to be more related to estrogen metabolites, the 16-hydroxyestrogens, particularly as published in the journal called Lupus. This was a 2002 study looking at the relationship between 16-hydroxyestrogens and the appearance of signs and symptoms and the severity in SLE patients. So I think that we see a correlation between a variety of environmental factors and dysregulation of the immune system, and estrogen is certainly in this list. So things that would help to modulate estrogen's metabolism. We also recognize stress plays a very big role in this as well. And there's a tremendously interesting paper that I thank Dr. Peter Medill, who's one of our longstanding supporters, physician in Sebastopol, California, that reminded me of this paper in the Journal of Neuroscience in 2005, which is volume 25, page 11045, talking about maternal programming of the stress response. And this is a very, very interesting paper that talks about how activation of the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis can initiate various types of messenger molecule changes, including inflammatory cytokines and other cell regulating substances that have to do with growth hormone and have to do with gene expression patterns that then create a feed forward cycle that can facilitate and activate stress response that we see as inflammation, and encourage and feed into the inflammatory pathway. This paper also is a very remarkable paper because it demonstrates, in animals at least, that you can epigenetically reverse this. Epigenetically means after the genes have been expressed, by altering the environment. And therefore, altering the environment could be anything from a stress management program to a nutrition intervention program by methylation of the genes and giving more methyl donor nutrients in these animals. It was found to be able to lower some of these stress responses in the offspring. So again, these are epigenetic types of phenomena that occur away from not modifying genes nor their immediate expression, but really what happens to the molecules, the messenger RNA, and the proteins after they've been formed post-translationally. And I think this is a huge new advancing concept in medicine, because we used to think that everything just came directly out of our genes and there was little we could do after the fact. Now we're recognizing the environment actually influences not only how our genes are expressed, but how those biomolecules that are expressed from the genes then get finally expressed into the phenotype and alter the metabolism and cell signaling and what we call the phenotypic component of the cell.
So what we say is that if you have a lot of these inflammatory conditions, you've got a lot of the dysregulation of the immune system, there are post-translational things that have been done, methylation patterns with folate, B6, B12, as well as stress reduction patterns play a role in this process. So with that in mind, let's move on to talk with our researcher of the month about estrogen metabolism.
Well, those of you that had the privilege of being at the 13th International Symposium on Functional Medicine were certainly very privileged, as was I, to hear Dr. Eleanor Rogan, one of our premier plenary lecturers, talk about the extraordinary work she's done over the years on estrogen metabolism. And this is such a very important area, and one that we've previously introduced into Functional Medicine Update with an interview with Dr. Rogan back in November 2003. I thought it would be important for all of our listeners to once again reacquaint themselves with the significance of Dr. Rogan's work. Just to remind you of her background, she's at the Epley Institute at the University of Nebraska, is absolutely a primary researcher and developer and really discoverer of the both mechanisms of and influence of these estrogen metabolites. This is very sophisticated chemistry. We're not talking about things that are produced at very high levels, and so methodologies have to be developed to analyze them and their reaction products. Many of these have very high reactivity, so they don't stick around in biological specimens very long, so we have to find analytical ways of demonstrating their presence, either by surrogate markers or direct chemistry types of analysis, and all this is very, very complicated in the cellular soup that we see in real animals. So it's with great precision that Dr. Rogan and her colleagues have been able to sort out this complex puzzle, and we're very, very fortunate to have her bring us the latest information in this emerging area, which I think has tremendous clinical implications around breast cancer, and I also believe around potentially prostate cancer as well, and there's some work that's been done suggesting that as well. So Dr. Rogan, once again, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your extraordinary work, 160 plus papers over the years. You're certainly the person in the field.
Thank you, Dr. Blanton.
I'd like to start off, if I could, and just for the individuals that may not have heard our interview in November 2003, nor were at the symposium, just to maybe bring us up to speed, how did you get into the estrogen metabolism area and make your discoveries concerning the 2-4-hydroxyestrogens?
Well, we've always been interested in the estrogens, but I began 30-some years ago studying another class of carcinogens called polycyclic hydrocarbons that are environmental pollutants in any kind of smoke, and studied them for 20-some years, understanding the kinds of DNA adducts that they form when they react in cells that initiates the process leading to cancer. And then we were able very quickly to move in the early 90s from the hydrocarbons over into the estrogens and apply what we'd learned from the hydrocarbons to the estrogens very quickly. What we already knew from the hydrocarbons was that the reactive forms that attack DNA and attach themselves on the purine bases, the adenines and guanines, causing those bases to fall out with the carcinogen attached, leaving behind gaps in the DNA message called apurinic sites, that these were the important adducts, and these relate to what kind of cancer-causing mutations you get. We also knew from other people's work that in the catecholestrogens, there's two of them, depending upon where the second or third OH group is, either on the 2 position or the 4 position, and we knew that the 2 position were at the 2 catecholestrogens were at best very weak carcinogens, whereas the 4 catecholestrogens are stronger carcinogens. And we immediately discovered that it's the reactive form of the 4 catecholestrogens, the so-called catecholestrogen quinone, that forms these so-called depurinating adducts that fall out of DNA, leaving behind the apurinic sites, whereas the 2 catecholestrogen quinones form the so-called stable adducts that's at a different position in DNA, and they stay in the DNA unless repair or removes them. And they do actually form the depurinating adducts, but at a much, much lower level than the 4 catecholestrogens. So we were able to apply all that. We also found that the oncogenic mutations that come from the depurinating adducts, again, it's from the 4 catecholestrogens starting there that you get the mutations. So all of this is fit together, and now we're applying that to humans.
Well, this is a very exciting, obviously, evolution of the story. And as I recall reading your work in our discussion in 2003, you talked about the different isoforms of cytochrome P450 that were involved in the formation of these different hydroxylated products, the difference between CYP1A1-2 and CYP1B1 and CYP3A4, each one of those being inducible, and therefore there may be different inducers that would drive things into different families. Am I summarizing correctly?
Yes, that's correct. None of it's an absolute, but certainly some of the inducers will induce more of the, let's say, the 1A family, and there's some, like, for example, TCDD particularly, dioxin, particularly induces the CYP1B1. And the CYP-P450-1B1 predominantly forms the four catechol estrogens, whereas the 1A, 1 or 2, predominantly forms the two catechol estrogens. And these two forms are the ones that are primarily present in extrahepatic tissues. The 3A4 is much more highly concentrated in the liver.
Let me move from your point about the inducing properties of CYP1A1 and 1B1. You made that, I think, very important point that the CYP1B1 and A1 are on extrahepatic tissues in high levels, where 3A4 is in hepatic tissues. And so that obviously then directs us towards the breast or the prostate. Is there any data that has come out of those tissues related to the activities of these transforming enzymes?
Well, they're certainly present. We've shown that they're present in the breast, that the 1B1 is present in the breast. The 1A1 is also present in the breast. We haven't published that, but it's also present. And we've also seen them in the prostate from animals, I would say that. So these enzymes are clearly present in breast tissue, both 1A1 and 1B1.
So from what you've said, if I'm putting words in your mouth, please correct me, but it would suggest then that in tissues where you have high potential activity of 1B1, that you might have higher risk to these apurinic bases, adducts, that come as a consequence of the 3,4 quinone estrogens from 4-hydroxylation.
I think that's exactly correct. When you have higher levels of 1B1, you are more likely to get the 4-catechol estrogens formed, and you do get higher levels of the DNA adducts formed. We have begun analyzing this in breast fluid from women with and without breast cancer, but I don't have any results to share with anybody yet. We think we see differences, but the work is too preliminary to really share on that. What I can tell you is we have published a very, very small preliminary study comparing breast tissue from women with breast cancer. This is the normal non-tumor tissue from women with breast cancer and women without breast cancer. We got that from reduction mammoplast excess tissue. And what we find is that the level of P450-1B1 is significantly higher in the breast tissue from women with breast cancer than in the women who don't have breast cancer. We looked at four different enzymes and found that the two we consider estrogen-activating enzymes are higher in the women with breast cancer and lower in the women who don't have breast cancer. And on the other hand, two enzymes that we consider protective against activation of estrogens are higher in women with healthy breasts compared to women who have breast cancer.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yes, that it fit right in with what we would have hoped.
So that then obviously begs the question, we've talked about the fact that these are inducible enzymes, so the inducers of some of them may be differential, different one from the other, and we talk about the cruciferous vegetable family and its relationship with purported epidemiological breast cancer risk reduction.
Yes.
So can you help tell us a little bit about the bioactives in crucifers and the impact that they have on these estrogen-transforming enzymes?
I think they have a variety of effects. One of the effects that they have is that I think that they have some compounds that will scavenge the reactive estrogen metabolites so that they're not reacting with DNA. That's one of the several effects they have. I think one of the most important effects that the cruciferous vegetables have is they have compounds that induce what I think is a very important enzyme, which is called quinone reductase. form of estrogens back to catechol estrogens, which are not reactive. And we're beginning to collect data to support this idea that it's the induction of quinone reductase that's a very important component of what the cruciferous vegetables do. I know that they also affect a variety of other cell processes that are anti-tumor. In addition to inducing these metabolic enzymes, I think they also have some effects on the repair of DNA damage and on some signaling pathways.
So then that leads us to look at some of the individual glucosinolate bioactive secondary metabolites, like indole-3-carbinol and some of its acid polymers, like 3,3-indole-methane, or what has been called diindole-methane. And in our field, there happens to be a fairly large controversy right now as to whether there is preference of one of those bioactives over the other in favorably affecting estrogen metabolism. So can you tell us a little bit about the 4-hydroxylation and the aromatic hydrocarbon receptor activation of indole-3-carbinol versus DIM as you've reviewed the literature?
Well, I certainly have reviewed this literature to try to sort out these differences. One of the confounding effects here is when you look, for example, in animals or even you give it to people, because the indole-3-carbinol is metabolized to the DIM, it's hard to sort out what's doing what. So you treat with indole-3-carbinol, but you don't know what the active component is. That really, I think, confuses the whole issue. However, when I reviewed this literature, I didn't see a great difference between what indole-3-carbinol was doing and what DIM was doing. There were small differences in the effects of these two compounds, or a few differences, but it didn't seem to me that people have demonstrated that there are significant differences here.
We were told at one recent meeting that there is a very significant difference in 4-hydroxylation patterns between the indole-3-carbinol and the diindole-methane. Is that seem to be true from your looking at the published literature?
You know, I have seen that opinion stated, and I've seen supported with citations, but then I go and read the papers in the literature, and I don't see that that's been demonstrated. I see that people have made some assumptions from work, for example, on P450-1A1 about 1B1, but I have not seen anybody actually demonstrate that. I've also read that administration of indole-3-carbinol significantly increases the amount of P450-1B1 and consequently the 4-catechol estrogens, but the only data I find in the literature shows a small increase that is far from being statistically significant.
So when we look at some of the purported adverse effects of either I3C or DIM, people have talked about cross-reactivity with the aromatic hydrocarbon receptor, or talked about the formation of 6-alpha-hydroxyestrogens, which you probably know more about by an order of magnitude than I do, but have implied that maybe there's some difference that could be seen in either AHR or in 6-alpha-hydroxyestrogens. Is there anything that you've seen that relates to those areas?
Well, I have seen it reported correctly that, for example, a study in women that were administered DIM, and there indeed the 2-hydroxylation to form the 2-catechol estrogens increased significantly, and that increased the ratio of the 2-catechol estrogens to the 16-alpha-hydroxy estrogens, which would be a good thing. Again, that difference was not quite statistically significant by the general standards. So it seemed to be going in the right direction, but it wasn't a conclusive study. And unfortunately, there hasn't been anything published specifically on the effects of indole-3-carbinol or DIM on the 4-hydroxylation of estrogens in humans.
And how about the effects in humans of indole-3-carbinol with the formation of the 2-hydroxy versus 16-hydroxy? Has that been adequately demonstrated?
Well, Yes, that improves this ratio of the two catechol estrogens to the 16-alpha-hydroxy estrogens. It's improved. Now, whether that's important or not, I wouldn't say has been demonstrated. In my view of the world of this whole subject, this is not a significant difference, but I don't really want to pretend to be an expert in terms of human medical issues. But well, the data are pretty marginal.
Let's, if we can, then talk about these intermediates, which I know you have done quite a bit of work on, which are the 2,3 and the 3,4 catechols, the quinones, and where they go in physiology. I'm now alluding to the methoxylation pathways.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Could you tell us a little bit about where they travel?
What happens to them? Mm-hmm. Well, these are pretty reactive compounds, and so they're going to react with something in the cell, in a cell. They won't travel very far in a cell. So they react, if they don't just react with water in the cell, they'll react with glutathione, which is a cellular scavenger for many kinds of oxidized products. That's a good thing because that takes them into being excreted. They can also react with DNA, which is a bad thing, and form these DNA adducts that can lead to the apuritic sites seem to be the source of the initiations that initiate cancer. The catechol estrogen 3,4 quinones are much more reactive than the catechol estrogen 2,3 quinones just because of their chemistry. So the formation of these DNA adducts by the 2,3 quinones is very small compared to the 3,4 quinones. So I think the major danger comes from the catechol estrogen 3,4 quinones. That's what seems to happen with them. They either react with DNA or they react with glutathione. They probably react with proteins too, although I don't think anyone's shown that particularly. But I don't think that would be a damaging thing. It would just kind of get rid of them. In the worst possible case, it might screw up a molecule of an enzyme, but that's not a big deal.
Well, one of the things that you point out, and it's really excellent review paper that was published last month that you authored in Vivo magazine, entitled The Natural Chemopreventive Compound Indole-3-Carbinol State of the Science, is that the two hydroxylation patterns that are facilitated by upregulating the enzymes associated with I3C go on to form the principally the methoxylated derivatives, which can be trapped, versus the 16-hydroxy compound that doesn't get methylated, so it may be a more promiscuous type of molecule. I think that's a very interesting concept, that you've got an exit opportunity for the 4 and the 2, but you don't seem to have that for the 16.
Right. And so the 16 can continue to have effects on various cellular processes, biochemical sorts of processes, signaling processes, things like that.
So do you feel that the ratio of 2 to 16 hydroxylated estrogens that are measured by laboratories is more of a surrogate marker for relative risk, and that what we really should be measuring is the 4-hydroxylation pattern, or do you feel that there is something that is of concern relative to the increased 16-hydroxylation?
Well, I think that it's really the 4-catechol estrogens that are the important ones to be measuring. I don't think it's been significantly shown that the ratio of the 2 to the 16-alpha is a particularly useful characteristic to measure. I think it's the 4-catechol estrogens here that are going to do the damage that's going to start a cell down the road to being a cancer cell, and that's what we should be measuring.
And if I interpret your review paper correctly, you're, I think, suggesting that to date there is no statistically significant data that says that either EIM nor I3C significantly elevate 4-hydroxy estrogens, at least demonstration of
proof
to date.
Correct. The only paper that I have seen that dealt with the 4-catechol estrogens was published in 1997, and there the differences in the 4, for example, the 4-hydroxyestrone, the so-called p-value, which normally you would want to be about at 5% or less, actually there the difference was only I'm reading it off here, 16%. And so that's just not significant. You can't rely on that. Normally you would want to have a 95% feel comfortable that 95% of the time that the difference you're seeing, let's say, in terms of the four catecholestrogens being induced, that 95% of the time at least you'd always see that result. In this case, you would only see it maybe 85% of the time, which is not really good enough to consider it a reliable difference.
So it sounds like there's still a lot of room for additional work, and there is other variables that are influencing this, as you mentioned, like methylation patterns and other things that participate maybe away from the 2 to 16 ratio that have to do with how these crucifers modulate cancer risk.
I think that's very true. I also think that in the next year, we'll probably publish a lot of data from humans that'll lay to rest a lot of these different controversies, because the technologies for doing these analyses have improved by orders of magnitude. The sophisticated kinds of analyses that you can do now that you couldn't really even do maybe 5 years ago with the same level of sensitivity and the ability to separate chemically or chromatographically all of these very similar compounds.
From what you've seen to date, being both a researcher, a woman, a mother, and a person of the universe, based on what we've seen, we would recommend women not to eat crucifers or not to have foods that contain either I3C or would be converted to DIM. Is there any evidence at this point that those would be hazardous?
Oh, I think absolutely not. I think in terms of eating crucifers, everything I have seen has said this is a really excellent thing to do. That food group, to me, is the most likely food group to help prevent cancer.
So it sounds to me like we are really at the threshold of some very exciting abilities using the methodologies that you're developing. And also, by the way, what you just said, I interpret that some of the past data that's been published probably is somewhat questionable just on methodological grounds, because maybe we didn't have the sensitivity to address some of these questions that we're now asking about 4-hydroxylation patterns. But it seems like we're at the threshold to really start being able to answer some of these very important questions as to how do the fractionated components out of crucifers like the phenylisothiocyanate or the indole-3-carbinol or the DIM or the sulfurophane influence these individual pathways.
Exactly. That's absolutely true. We happen to be looking at the levels in urine, serum, different body fluids and tissues, but I think that other laboratories who have access to much of the same improved analytical technology are going to be doing the experiments to look, the studies, to look at what happens when people ingest these components of the crucifers. For example, there was a paper about 6 months ago from Greg Reed's lab at the University of Kansas, and analytically it was the nicest paper that I've seen. It's the most advanced. Unfortunately, they didn't look at the four catecholestrogens, but they were already using much better technology than was available 6, 8, 10 years ago.
Well, I guess this breaks down to one last question, and that is, as we look at where we are today, do you feel that we're seeing the emergence of a new field of chemo prevention that's going to be focused on personalized diets based upon these metabolic characteristics of estrogen metabolism?
I do. I absolutely do think that, and I think that that is, for me and for our research group, this is really the goal, to use, I'll call them dietary supplements of natural chemicals and tailored to different people's basic metabolic profile, so to contain the estrogen so that you either don't form these reactive metabolites or you scavenge them, etc., so that they are much less likely to damage DNA and start the process leading to cancer. And I think this whole field is going to take tremendous strides forward in the next few years, very, very few years.
At present in the literature, is there any greater prevalence of human clinical work with indole-3-carbinol versus dienoyl methane, or are the published papers about the same between the two phytochemicals?
There's more on indole-3-carbinol.
So it sounds to me like we're really awaiting what will be an extraordinary next couple of years with you and your colleagues and your associates in helping us to really piece this together and move us towards personalized medicine.
I think so. I'm very confident about that.
Well, thank you very much. Well, again, we thank you for all this. I know it's extraordinarily hard and diligent work, but it to me is putting the science under what has been observed epidemiologically for a long period of time without no an explanation. So I think we're going to save a lot of unnecessary misery and suffering as a consequence of the application of your discovery. So thanks so much.
I hope so. That is certainly the goal.
Once again, Dr. Ruben, our best to you, and we'll talk to you soon as the data starts coming out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Blank. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to spend the last few minutes of this edition just kind of reviewing the takeaways from what we've been speaking about. You recall that we're talking about estrogen, and we talked a little bit about dietary intervention, the low-fat diets, and its interrelationship with women's health. What I didn't mention, which I think is clearly apparent to most of you that have been in this field for some time, is that moving to a more vegetable-based, minimally processed diet modifies estrogen production and metabolism quite dramatically and has an effect on then the outcome from estrogen states of modified function. So we know that in vegetarian women, I'm talking now about the work that Joanna Dwyer and others have done and published over the years, there is an altered estrogen level, there's improved progesterone, androgen, estrogen balance, and there is increased metabolism and alteration in sex-binding hormone globulin levels so that what we ultimately end up with is a better regulated endocrine system. We also recognize from the discussion that I had earlier concerning the reversal of maternal program of stress responses that the immediate environment of the individual can influence aspects of hormone balance. So we talk about the neuroendocrine or the psychoneuroendocrine environment playing a very important role in modulating some of these factors. We also talked about the dietary factors that influence estrogen metabolism directly by hydroxylation, the wonderful work of Dr. Rogan, and then how these intermediary metabolites that come through the regulation of the cytochrome P450s that metabolize estradiol and estrone into its various hydroxylated derivatives can be encouraged to eliminate these estrogens in a non-toxic form through either methylation through methylation enzymes that go through S-adenosylmethionine. This is the catechol-O-methyltransferase enzymes, and that they can be facilitated with proper levels of substrates of the SAMs, S-adenosylmethionine, by proper B6, folate, B12, and betaine nutriture. So many women who are on marginal diets relative to these methylating nutrients would benefit significantly by increasing those four nutrients in their diet so as to promote proper methylation of their hydroxyestrogens. We also talked about the use of the crucifers and their glucosinolate breakdown products, indole-3-carbinol and dienoyl methane, to facilitate the improved formation of the two hydroxylated estrogens at the expense of the 16. And we wanted to say both the 2 and 4 hydroxyestrogens can be trapped as the methylated derivatives, whereas the 16 hydroxy cannot. So we talk about 1 to 2 portion sizes of cruciferous vegetables a day, or somewhere in the range of 200 to 300 milligrams of indole-3-carbinol equivalent that comes from the crucifer glucosinolates is the level that has been demonstrated in clinical trials to have positive effects on function in women. These are hormone-driven functions like papillomas that have been demonstrated with I3C supplementation to improve. So what I'm really starting to see emerge is this recognition that many of these women health issues that occur postmenopausally are more than just modifying the protein, carbohydrate, and fat level in the diet. There's this whole rich library of phytochemicals that are present in a minimally processed diet that has color that have influence on function. This may also explain some of the more recent studies that have been published around bone loss in women postmenopausally that didn't seem to be effectively managed by calcium and vitamin D supplements. This was a big aha coming out of the Women's Health Initiative that you heard about recently, that calcium and vitamin D supplements did not seem to reduce fracture incidence in these women. And I believe this is because, again, osteoporosis and bone fracture is more than just a calcium and vitamin D problem. It's also an inflammatory signaling problem. The osteoclast, the bone resorbing unit, is stimulated into resorption as a consequence of inflammatory signaling. And therefore, if you eat a diet that's of a low inflammation content that has these rich gene-programmed nutrients in it that lowers inflammatory potential, that will have a better effect on reducing osteoporosis risk than just focusing on calcium and vitamin D alone supplemented into a diet that's white.
And so, again, I keep coming back to how does a woman's body, how does her estrogen and androgens travel properly? We have to look in a historical and evolutionary perspective, I think, to better understand that, because historically women have eaten complex diets, rich in an array of all these signaling molecules and foods that have impact upon estrogen balance production and metabolism. And then we lastly talked about things in the diet that may precipitate then an alarm reaction or a allergy type reaction. And that obviously has to do with things that in one person's diet may appear to be a very good food, and in another person's diet is not such a good food because it alerts the immune system to doing battle. And here I'm talking about things like gluten or alpha-gliadin found in cereals, and things like casein, which is a milk protein, beta-casein, that may initiate immunological reactions in certain individuals. There is an ever-increasing understanding of the changing patterns of food allergy, a very nice paper authored by Dr. John Walker Smith, a very nice review paper in the European Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, volume 17, page 1313, talked about food allergy affecting many more people than we previously thought, and that this food allergy may really be considered food sensitivity, because some of these are not traditionally seen types of allergies, but may have other types of effects by influencing things like enteric flora. And certain foods may then alter flora, which then secondarily has an influence on GI mucosal immune function and causing inflammation. So it's both a direct effect of the food constituent and possibly an indirect effect. And we recognize that the management of these types of food reactions, these what we call allergies, is in part related to the full composition of the diet. Things like components of the diet that support proper bacterial flora. Flora that would be, quote, anti-inflammatory versus pro-inflammatory type of flora. And in fact, again, some very nice work done on showing that supplementation orally with probiotic supplements can help to lower food reactions and food sensitivity. This is European Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, volume 17, page 1305 in 2005. So certain species of probiotic organisms, when administered orally, may have a salutary effect on food reactions and lowered immune potential in the gut and lowered gut inflammatory conditions. So we're talking both about localized gut inflammation seen in things like Crohn's or IBD, and maybe systemic inflammatory conditions as well, seen with arthritis-like symptoms. As you get a breakdown of the gut mucosal barrier and get a permeable gut, it increases, therefore, the relative risk that you've now given exposure of these antigens to your gut mucosal immune system, which then can signal to the rest of the body this inflammatory process. So gut barrier immune function is very, very important, the integrity of your gut mucosa. In fact, breakdown of gut mucosal integrity is often a hallmark of long-term food-related allergy at the gut level. Antigens can then penetrate the mucosa and induce allergic inflammation. Again, from the European Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, an article that describes this is that found in volume 17, page 1279. Increasing intestinal epithelia and the breakdown of gut mucosal barrier function, which is associated with allergy or inflammatory reactions of the gut. By the way, clinically, the way that one often goes about understanding this is by taking a stool sample and measuring the level of calprotectin in the stool. Calprotectin is a inflammatory response protein that is produced and shed by neutrophils in the gut, and high levels of calprotectin in the stool are indicative as a marker of gut inflammation. It's also very tightly correlated with that of increased intestinal permeability that could be measured by things like the oral lactulose mannitol challenge test, which you probably are familiar with. But we're finding much more clinical utility in using the fecal calprotectin test. When you get high levels of calpro, we've seen patients now with calprotectins up at the level of 200 when the normal range is less than 30, who really have very serious breakdown of gut mucosal integrity, a lot of gut inflammation, and have systemic inflammatory conditions that can be precipitated or aggravated by this immune response. So I think, again, trying to look at the interrelationship of the system, gut connected to immune system, connected to liver, connected to all the circulating white cells, and how that influences then physiological health. In this case, estrogen, estrogen metabolites, and ultimately female-related health problems that are associated with different cycles in a woman's development, including perimenopause and menopause. Lastly, as you probably know, when you have these increasing inflammatory signals, you also have increasing risk to mitochondrial dysfunction. And one of the things that is very interesting in women is this condition of postpartum seizures. Postpartum seizures is a really pathophysiological condition that is associated with alteration in neuroendocrine signaling, particularly allopregnanolone, pregnenolone, progesterone, and estrogen. When you get these wide swings in these neuroactive hormones, it often can lead to depolarization, mitochondrial uncoupling, and seizure disorders. We know that mitochondrial dysfunction is implicated as a contributing factor in a diverse range of acute and chronic neurologic disorders, but the one that I think is most interesting related to estrogen is this postpartum seizure condition that's seen in some women. We recognize that this comes as a consequence of these very rapid alterations in androgen-estrogen ratio levels in women, and that leads to alteration in membrane polarizability and changes in mitochondrial function. So then that leads us to question, okay, what about these conditions? What alters these things? And certainly the stability of estrogen signaling and of progesterone signaling play very important roles in normalizing the nervous system. I've taken an extraordinary example talking about postpartum seizures, but we might think about chronic neurological dysfunctions that are associated with endocrine ratio changes in women who are even menstruating as they go through the estrogenic and the androgenic phases of their menstrual cycle. And how does this interrelate then with mitochondrial function and energy depolarization and eventually alterations in central nervous system and peripheral nervous system function? So there are some very significant work that's now ongoing to look at the connection together between the nervous, immune, and endocrine systems in women to try to understand what the modifying factors are, the balancing factors. And the only way we can really understand this is to look at the system as a web. You can't look at it as a single agent. You've got to look at it as a web of interacting variables. The nervous, immune, and endocrine system are tied together intimately through receptors and signaling molecules. So as we start to develop this functional medicine model, we're led into recognizing the importance that the gut connects to the liver, connects to the immune system, connects to the inflammation system, connects to the cardiovascular system, connects to the nervous system. And the approach that we've been describing in this month's issue of Functional Medicine Update is to really look at estrogen more as a surrogate signaling molecule as to how it then interrelates with different cycles and functions, and how that connects to the neuroendocrine immune system, how that connects then ultimately to its metabolism and excretion through hydroxylation patterns and through methylation patterns. Once you get to that level, you start understanding possibly why it is that autoimmune disease is very heavily centered in women, why it is that postmenopausal women have cardiovascular disease, neurological disease, bone loss as principal features of their health histories, and why it is that the environment plays such an important role through proper dietary manipulation and lifestyle manipulation as serving as, quote, the best medicine. I hope that's of some interest and help to you, and we'll look forward to sharing in the month of May. Thank you.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted to Synthesis by Jeffrey Bland. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.